This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. HuntStand is the most popular and functional mobile hunting app on the market. With a variety of base maps to choose from, satellite imagery that is updated every month, the ability to check the weather, know property information, and even catalog your trail cam pics, HuntStand even gives you the ability to import pins and location markers from other mobile apps. Visit HuntStand.com or download wherever you download your apps. Enter discount code SN20 at checkout for 20% off.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands you need, from athletic stuff, like a full-court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff, like a half-mile stroll. Get those steps in! And for morning hikes up the mountain trail, good pace, to nighttime ghost stories from the camping chair. What a twist! Whatever level of active, Sierra loves it all. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Close your eyes, exhale, feel your body relax, and let go of whatever you're carrying today.
Well, I'm letting go of the worry that I wouldn't get my new contacts in time for this class. I got them delivered free from 1-800-CONTACTS. Oh my gosh, they're so fast.
And breathe.
Oh, sorry. I almost couldn't breathe when I saw the discount they gave me on my first order. Oh, sorry. Namaste.
Visit 1-800-CONTACTS.com today to save on your first order.
1-800-CONTACTS.
Welcome to Maximize Your Hunt, the podcast dedicated to those who want the most out of their hunting property. This podcast explores land management, habitat improvement, and hunting strategies that will help you maximize your time in the field. Follow along as industry professionals that live and breathe white-tailed deer share their secrets to success. And now, the founder of Whitetail Landscapes, your host, John Teeter.
Hi, I'm John Teeter of Whitetail Landscapes. This is Maximize Your Hunt. Welcome back. This is going to be part two. On the first episode, we talked about logging and timber sales. We're going to get more into the logging, some of the processes and issues. And I want to lead off, not getting into the specific topic per se, but talking a little bit about kind of the building blocks of this whole business that I have. And I wanted to kind of portray a couple key components of how I view my business and the community around me that does this type of work, those that have interest in this type of work. And the building blocks are really simple. And this is a little bit left field, and I want to bring this up because I've been thinking more about, you know, how we approach things and our attitude and the significance of, you know, managing habitat for deer, you know, emphasizing strategic hunting, those type of things. And the first thing I start with is building a community of people around you that enjoy this lifestyle. That's a really important thing. Josh Stryker, who will come on in a little bit, is one of those individuals in my life that enjoys. I have several friends that I'm close with that have a similar lifestyle mindset. All the contributors obviously have a similar mindset. It's building community around you. It could be community, family, friends, neighbors, building a community of like-mindedness that's going to get you closer to your opportunity. So opportunity is number two. Opportunity is one of these building blocks where you're focused on what the end goal might be, potentially. Opportunity of building something, evolving something. We talk about the expediency of hiring a consultant and compacting time so you can do things quicker. One example is sometimes people hire life coaches. Sometimes people hire trainers to help them get bigger and bulkier faster. You know, using your resources, your community drives opportunity. And the last piece of it is having fun. If this doesn't bring you joy, don't do it. And if it brings you joy in small increments, then take it in small increments. Totally left field conversation, but something that was on my mind today. I wrote that down before the podcast and I felt like I'd share it with everybody. Those are the building blocks of my business. Those people that hire me think about those things. So I'd ask you think about those things. And I got to bring this up as well. I was listening to a podcast today. I went for a run. I'm running a little bit more before hunting season. I want to stay in shape. And I was doing my run. I was listening to a podcast. And I was listening to one of the people that is well-known in the industry. Extremely well-known. I won't say his name. I won't even say the podcast because it doesn't matter. But there's a preach and teach piece of this that's critical. And in that conversation, I recognize that that individual, where they have a PhD, whatever they have for education, their experience level is specific to their area, specific to their mindset and what they viewed over time. Some of those things that they suggest or recommend aren't correct. I turned off the podcast and I said, I can't listen to this anymore. He said one thing completely incorrect, and he stood by that several times in the conversation. Here's what I'm telling you all, and I want to say this not to be critical of that individual or a podcast or anything like that. Be critical of recommendations. I am not always right. And the people are on this podcast are not always correct. Be critical. And as more you're critical, the more answers you'll find, the more whys you'll answer, you know, the more what us will get corrected. And it's important to start thinking that way. And so I bring this up as just a mindset thing. Focus on community, opportunity, fun, and be critical. And critical in a nice way. I'll listen to the rest of the podcast, but it just makes me think deeper about certain topics. And let's be clear, we'll never know everything. All right. Now we're going to get into the podcast. I wanted to start an intro like that because there's a lot on my mind today, but we got Josh back on the line. Hey, Josh, how you doing, man?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. So I just did my rant. Hopefully you enjoyed that piece of it. What's been going on? What have you been up to?
Just trying to finish up a few jobs. Got a couple of them just coming to a close, getting things wrapped up with the landowners, finished cutting trees on one. And touching base with a guy. I'm in the middle of one. I kind of haven't been back there in a couple weeks, I think. So just trying to keep everything flowing.
Yeah, and we've had quite a bit of rain over the past week or so. In certain areas, it's been spotty. I have a client just north of us, and he didn't get the rain that we got here in Tully, where I live. It's kind of funny like that. Have you had a lot of rain on the job sites?
It's funny. There's been one job that's been, it got hit 2-3 days in a row. And the other one got a couple sprinkles, and they're maybe 6 miles apart.
Interesting.
So it's been very interesting.
Yeah, these weather fronts, you got to pay attention to them for your food plots, obviously, you know, in your specific discipline. So let's, I have an Instagram page. If you don't follow me on Instagram, please do. I hate Instagram, and I just want to be clear about that, but I need it for my business. I need it to reach out. I need it to kind of help market my business, but I really despise Instagram. But the nice part about Instagram, I get to connect to people. So that is the good part. The bureaucracy and some of the details of Instagram, I'm communicating through some people, even clients who are Instagram. I don't mind doing that, but it's not my favorite thing. But I asked some questions this week, or I put out a post to say, hey, if you got any questions. So we got a few questions, and I figured we'll start with those first, Josh, and then we'll kind of lead into maybe some specifics, things that we want to get into ourselves to help the listener base kind of grow their mindset in this area. So I'll give you some of the questions, and I'll let you respond, or I may respond, and we'll go from there. First question, is it worth having a logger bring the wood to a landing site for people to bid on the logs? Is that a benefit to the landowner?
Yes, it is. If you're working directly with the logger, that would be, unless you're very comfortable with your logger and just having them ship where he says we'll bring the best money, that would be the second best option. And it gives you a real good idea of where different mills are hitting with prices.
Josh, would you recommend doing that through, like, our job, for example? When we brought my job up last time, my specific property, we brought out the first load and we kind of sorted out prices based upon that initial bid. So we kind of knew what the pay rate was. Would you recommend doing that for every single load or individual loads? How do you typically handle that?
It kind of depends. You can do it every single load. It's a lot of work on the logger to lay out and then pick up. I can't remember if we did it two or three. I can't remember if we did two or three batches on your job.
Yeah.
I know there was a couple different winning bidders, but we might have done it three times. Because if I remember right, one guy won, and then somebody else won. Yep. The other two times, and we worked it out to just move it direct to them.
Yeah, I remember that was and I'm sure it varies depending on the, you know, obviously the volume. But once it hits the ground, you know, and everybody has the opportunity to assess it, each mill is going to have a different demand for that type of wood, and they're going to grade it differently. And then obviously you've got the logger and the landowner could, you know, evaluate that as well. And you have the ability to kind of assess log quality, depending on the amount of mineral, size of heart, you know, some of the basics, principles. What do you look at when you look at logs, like when you're doing the grade?
I mean, when you're looking for grade, most of your money is in your butt logs, the logs that are closer to the stump, closer to the ground. Your first two logs are typically your best. And you're looking for, usually there's no limbs in those first couple logs, so you're looking at, you know, defects just in the bark. You know, sometimes it's a bump, which would be a defect. And when you get into veneers, you're looking at just defects in the bark. I mean, just unsymmetrical. They can be about the size of a pack of a deck of cards. And you're looking at those types of things for veneer. And then you're also looking at the wood itself for mineral, or you might get some T-bark in there. And that's just defects within the wood itself, not the exterior.
Okay, I think we nailed that question. Next question is, people want to hear more on finding stumpage prices and estimating standing timber. Can you kind of walk us through some of the things you might do? We talked a little bit about that in the last podcast.
Yeah, so, and this can be different. I'm not certain with other states, but I know here in New York State, you can get right on the New York State DEC website and they'll give you the past stumpage reports. You can find the last couple of years, and they'll give you graphs for the last, I want to say it's like the last 20 years, and what the timber markets have been doing as far as up and down. And that's the best place I've found to find the most recent stumpage prices.
Yeah, that's kind of a good bio to look past. And, you know, you can see kind of the resume over the years of what they've been paying and time of year, region specific, right?
Yep.
Species specific. Yep. Species specific, obviously.
Everything is itemized on there.
Yeah. All right. Estimating standing timber. Now, we should do it the professional way, because the John Teeter way was like hillbilly style. I had a square, and I was measuring log height with a rangefinder. So what do you think of that, buddy? What do you think of that for a strategy?
That's pretty specific.
Well, I wanted to know, you know, was that log going to be 34 or 36? Okay. And yeah, my records were very complete when I was working with you, but how do you do it in the real world?
For a diameter, you can get a diameter tape, but most guys, anybody that buys standing timber, they would typically be running a Biltmore stick. And that is a stick that estimates the value in the trees on a Doyle rule scale. And you can get your diameter of best height. And you can also get, if you step back from the tree, I believe it's 66 feet, you can hold this stick up a different direction, and it'll tell you how many 16-foot logs are in the tree. And of course, if you fall somewhere in the middle, then that would be a half a log. And then you can go right down through the stick, look at your diameter and how many logs you have, and it'll give you the board footage in that tree.
Sounds simple enough, and probably a good tool to have, certainly in your business. Anything
it's
else?
Must have.
It's a must have. Yeah, absolutely. And certainly something when you're walking the landing site, or excuse me, when you're walking a lot with the landowner, you know, something you may want to ask about. You know, can you walk us through how you evaluate, you know, the quantity? Certainly if they're buying standing, I mean, that would be a must to me. I mean, versus the alternative, if they're, you know, they're cutting everything down and then you're scaling everything and you're making the determination of your volume and you're selling out to the best bidder. I'm going to add a little bit to the question earlier, because I just thought about this is, you know, if you're working with a logger, there's nothing to say that you can't look at the scaling sheets to know what the volume they purchased and ensure that the payment amount correlates specifically. You know, do a check on your logger. Now, that may not be totally understandable because the scaling sheets, the way that they measure logs and stuff like that, the volume doesn't necessarily make sense a lot of times. But if you are able to understand the math and the related payment, that could give you more clarification to make sure that nobody's taking you, taking you to the hopper and not being honest with you, so to speak. So I'll just add that to the conversation. Have you had anybody go down that road, Josh? Because I think I'm a little particular compared to most.
It varies. I have had people, you know, as soon as the wood's leaving, they want to see what they bought. They want the footage and the dollars. You know, they might not necessarily want to check right then, but they want to know. And most recently, I would say pretty much majority of my jobs have either been bot standing or people that just trust me and they'll ask me how's it going throughout the job, and that's about it. And I'll sit down with them at the end with all the numbers and square up with them. I haven't been questioned much lately.
That's good. That's good that people have faith, and certainly that says a lot about you. All right, third question, and I think this is where we'll end it with questions, because we probably want to talk about a few other things. What is the typical timetable to expect from harvest to check in hand? And that's a bit of a loaded question. It's a good question. There's a lot to that question, though. So
that is a good question. Well, I guess hopefully I can answer all of that pretty thoroughly. But I typically try to get a 2-year contract, whether it's a percentage or whether I buy it standing. And it gives me time to put that job in the best place I can. Some jobs are more of a summer cut job. Some jobs can only be done in the winter. Some have really good ground and I can work them in a wetter time of year. And some of it depends on the wood quality. And then as far as start to finish, it depends on the size of the job. I mean, I work by myself. And I would say when the conditions are right on a good week, throughout the winter, I would say I'm doing about 20,000 feet a week. In the summer is really hit or miss. You know, I've only done 5,000 to 10,000 feet a week if we get, you know, a wetter week. But it can't really give you a good grasp on how long, and it just all depends on the job.
Josh, let me bring up another topic. So let's say a landowner is a little anxious and they're taking out around, we'll just say 30,000 feet, and you're taking out in around 10,000 increments, just round math, right? So three basic loads. And when you're taking out those loads, have you have instances where you're paying the landowner per load per se, rather than the full lot? So it's almost like, okay, it's itemized for this load and then next load, then the next load. Have you had any instances like that?
Yep, I have.
Okay.
I had a landowner just over the winter. He wanted to know where he was at. And I think that he's been down the road a few times, and I think he's had some not good situations happen, and he just wanted the first load that left, he was very antsy. He was right there. He wanted to know how much wood left and how much money was there. And then as the job went on, you know, the second load, I called him and let him know what had left and how much money. And he kind of, he said, well, we'll catch up on the next one. And then, you know, by the time the job was done, I think I owed him for, I don't know, another four or five loads. So he kind of settled down and relaxed a little bit.
Yeah. And I think that's good that, you could step in a situation and kind of cure that issue and set it right for some people. Like we talked earlier, you know, there's people that have gotten burned, loggers, foresters, that they may have not been very honest and trustworthy. So it's good to kind of reinstill, you know, there's integrity in this business and in what you do specifically. So commend you for that. All right. Those are the questions we're going to end with. I appreciate everybody actually submitting questions and responding to my inquiry the other day on Instagram. So thank you for doing that. And I'll continue to probably do that through these podcasts just to get a little more feedback. And I, you know, reach out to me. You want to air a topic, you know, I'll throw it into the conversation and we'll try to be raw and real and crass and figure out, you know, the best way to answer your particular question and hopefully be as correct as possible. So nobody shuts me off. All right. Let's get into, let's see, what do we want to start with? What do you want to start with? Because there's a couple things I want to talk about.
I'm here for you, buddy.
All right.
I'm just flying by the seat of my pants here.
That's great. So Josh called this podcast to talk about. So in this talk about right now, because clearly he listens to a lot of podcasts, but in this talk about right now, I want to talk about bad decisions in logging. And I'm going to be critical of me. So Josh follows me sometimes. Maybe he shouldn't. Maybe he shouldn't take the jobs I recommend him going on, or maybe he shouldn't listen to me at times. He's very pragmatic and aware and has good insight into things. So I've got Josh in a few pickles, and I got him in a pickle on my own property. I have got some more timber that I want to take off. I don't know if we'll ever take it off, but at one point I wanted to take it off. Very hard area to get to. So I talked to my neighbor, went through my neighbor's property, he gave us permission. And we pretty much got your giant skidder almost stuck on a cold, nasty, stormy, no good, very bad day. And needless to say, you had good humor about it, but inside you wanted to kill me, I'm sure. Do you remember that day?
Well, I remember because I remember you telling me, oh, it's a breeze. It's a piece of cake. I got it all mapped out. Just drop the machine off and I'll walk you down through there. No problems.
No problems. It's always no problems with me, man. That's the way it goes. And I've said this before. It's grit and grace. You know, there's a little grit involved and a little grace. And sometimes we got to find the middle point. And I just figured we could just kind of grace our way right through those wet areas. Let's talk about why that didn't work. And let's talk about the problems that persisted as a result of that. So I made a decision to, I want to put bedding in a lower portion of my property. Actually, functionally, it probably wouldn't work good based upon the neighbor's hunting strategy as of recent. So probably a good reason I didn't cut it, or maybe an afterthought for that matter. I think we were going to probably cut the area down, maybe 40 trees in a section, some pretty good quality trees. And you know, to get there, we had to kind of up, down, cross some wet areas, no creeks or crossings like that, but a lot of seeps. Now, in a lot of the areas that we work on, there's rutting hazard areas or areas that are problematic. So time of year is critical. Josh, you brought that up last time. You know, picking the right time of year to cut a specific area, or you might have to build a bridge, or you might have to be a little more tactical when you go into these areas. What did you see in the failures in that equation? And be critical of me.
Those wetter areas, those are ones you typically want to get in the winter. If you get the snow off, usually you can get them to freeze. And it might take a day or two, but you can usually get it. And that was what we ran into on your piece. It's a hillside with springs. And there was, I don't remember how much snow was there, quite a bit, 2 or 3 feet.
Yeah. Yep.
And just, you know, when you have that much snow and you have water coming out of the ground, it's never going to freeze.
So snow creates basically a blanket, and in order to remove the blanket, you know, to clear those areas out, that potentially, depending on the temperature, decreases the rutting hazard situation. So I'll give you a basic rule, and I'm going to dumb this down when we go a little bit further into this topic. But generally speaking, wet soils or wetter areas, you're going to want to do those in the wintertime. Those are typically like soils that are more medium textured soils. Good example might be as you get kind of down the scale, we've got clay soils. Those are definitely fine soils. And then as you kind of lean back, you're kind of getting to the silty, loamy soils. And then sand, which really has good infiltration, the drainage is pretty good. You know, those are kind of all time of the year type soils. Most of the time, those are done in the summertime. But the soil type is a consideration when you're doing these layouts and when you're choosing areas to go into. Josh, what have you experienced? Because you do this all the time. What areas do you tend to stay away from in the wintertime that you prefer in the summertime? That kind of example, you kind of just actually answered that question. But what's your strategy normally?
Yeah, you just said it. I mean, there's really no area I really stay away from, per se, in the wintertime. It's really more a summertime strategy.
Yeah.
Because our winters have been narrowed down to, I mean, what do we have, 2 good months?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, the bottom line is, you know, like medium to fine texture soil, clay, loamy, silt loam, silty clay, you know, heavy clay. Okay, those are more winter. Okay, winter, we were going to have those areas kind of freeze over. And then as we decrease, you know, this is kind of more coarse, the sandy loam type soils. Now I have sandy loam on portions of my property. I have silty loam on portions of my property. I've got a lot of diverse soil types. I've got clay in a couple areas. So it's trying to look at the soil type. With my clients, I look at rutting hazards. I look at hydrology, you know, the ability of a soil's infiltration abilities. So I'm looking at those as characteristics, a part of food plotting, a part of logging, a part of access trails that all kind of plays into the equation of laying out a property. Now, I know that might sound a little sophisticated, and it is, right? Because you got to have some awareness on what is what and what's good and what's bad. But generally speaking, you've got to take a more in-depth look in these layouts. Now, this is a secret to my success. This is one of the things we talk about in the podcast. Josh knows this stuff because every day he's got to go in there and figure out, okay, what can I do where? What is the easiest path? And look at this. This is why I was trying to make fun of myself earlier. I said, Josh, it's going to be easy. Come down. We'll just blast through it. Chop up some trees. I got my big saw. Let's rock and roll. And he gets stuck. So as the non-practitioner, I need to rely on Josh as the implementation guy to figure these things out. And I just wanted to kind of make fun of me and be critical of my decisions. Like I said earlier, not everybody's right. So, Josh, any more comments on my stupidity?
No, I mean, I knew when I drove down into that hemlock swamp that it wasn't going to be good.
Yeah, and you should have said, why am I listening to this guy?
Pretty much.
Well, at least we can be honest with each other and make fun of my poor decisions. But we learned, right? And then from that, you know, you're more critical of me and I'm more specific now. But I've been a little bit better. I have done better now going forward. Years later, I'm a little more advanced in some of my thought process. And hopefully from this, people think a little more deeply. So rutting hazards. Have you got into situations where, you know, you're running over an area over and over and over again, and you got these big, deep ruts because the weather's changed, maybe you're mudding season, the landowner says they want it done. Have you had some issues related to that type of stuff and any related drama?
I have. It was partially my own fault. I had looked at a job in the summertime. I knew it needed to be cut in the winter. It was wetter, kind of like your property, generally wet to begin with, and there was a whole bunch of just swampy open areas. And when I showed up to do the job in January, I had the perfect skid trail mapped out in my mind, and I got out into it, and it just happened to be one of those swamp holes. And I looked around and looked around and looked around, and I could not find another way around it, so I ended up having to, I actually drove tops into that one, you know, nice branchy tops, and just packed them down in, and it froze in.
So we had jobs that you didn't work on, but I had clients this year that, and I'm sure they're listening to the podcast, feller bunchers. They had big, huge machines on their properties, you know, cutting. And I love that style to some degree, because you can do like really good layout with the tops, right? And yep. It's really kind of, it becomes very efficient, but those machines are heavy. I mean, what's a typical feller buncher? I know they're much heavier than your skidding equipment.
Much heavier.
Yeah.
I know my biggest machining is pushing 30,000 pounds. I want to say don't quote me on this. I don't keep up on the feller bunchers. I'm not into them, but I think his is somewhere around 50,000 pounds, I want to say.
Yeah. Yeah, that's not surprising. So, you know, the compaction as a result of using a machine like that may be far greater. And like to your point earlier, when they're doing those layouts and selecting the areas, I mean, they're running over tops or using the slash debris as bridging equipment. That brings up another conversation. Actually, let me stick with compaction for a second. So have you had, or have you come up with any strategies that you think work to handling compaction issues? And I'll talk a little bit about what I've thought about. What, you know, when you run over an area on a constant basis and you've got all that compaction, what are some good ideas for landowners to kind of relieve that situation?
The only thing that I do, I mean, if I know I got to cross the swamp, I'm putting crane mats down. Mm-hmm. And that just handles the weight of the machine. And the only other thing from that, you can corduroy it, which is just laying logs down, which is the same thing as a crane mat. It just takes more manpower to do it, more hours. And you can put treetops down. Sometimes works, depends on how soft it is. And that's only if you have to cross there.
What about the remediation? So let's say you're traveling across a farm field, and there's compaction almost creating a permanent road, and it becomes compacted and it becomes a runway for, you know, water to travel down it. What are some strategies there?
Typically in a scenario like that, when we're done, I would put water bars in with the dozer to get the water to drain off the roadway.
Have you also considered either adding dirt or coming in with deep tillage and trying to remediate some of the soil compaction?
I've never had to.
Well, let me bring in my perspective on things. So my property and other clients may have experienced this is, you know, I planted some trees. I broke up one of my fields, and the skid road out of one of my fields, you know, I think we went right through the center of the field. There was quite a bit of compaction. Our time of year, everything we did was correct, but there's still a lot of compaction. So it's funny because I went in, I actually put in a screen. I was doing kind of like a screening shelter belt type style. I was doing a field conversion and I was breaking up a field in half, and I was planting willows and I was trying to stick willows in the ground, and I couldn't get the willow cutting very deep in the ground. And I was like, what the heck? You know, I hadn't thought we had that much compaction. Well, what I had to do is I had to go in there and rototill that particular area to aerate it. Because what happens a lot of times when you have compaction, you start to lose the volume, the porosity of that soil. So there's decreased oxygen. And then if your oxygen levels get so low in the soil, things can't grow. And also you can't stick things in the ground either. There's not the activity, you know, because of the soil. So there's not a lot of activity that's going on in the soil. And as a result, you won't get things to grow in those particular areas. Or the plants that do grow in those areas are very familiar with compacted soils. Plantain's a good example. So there's some strategies there. There's some cultivating tools that you can use, deep tillage tools that you can use to aerate, so you can add soil onto those areas. So it's adding soil onto a hard pan. Not always the best advice, but those are options for you. So I thought I'd add to that, Josh, because I've had to deal with this complication on some clients' properties when they've had some issues. But any thoughts on anything I said?
Good thoughts.
Okay, good thoughts. Yeah, and I agree good because the bottom line is the harder the ground, the less infiltration we get. And of course, you know, that'll lead to runoff issues. And your suggestion with water bars makes a lot of sense. And the oxygen discussion is also kind of critical in that equation. All right, fun topics. Let's talk about layout, because we said that in the last. We're going to talk a little bit about layout. So you get to do the work. You're coming in, you're marking trees, and then you're overlaying maybe like a habitat plan for deer, and you're looking at the habitat plan in concert with a logging plan. How does that kind of construct in your mind? How do you kind of put the two and two together? Because they could be kind of different, right? Because in some cases, you're selecting certain trees for harvesting purposes, and that may or may not correlate with where we want bedding or where we want food. So, you know, what are your thoughts there?
I mean, really, as far as the overlay, I mean, you want to cut, you're cutting the mature trees out. And so if you're doing it on a deer habitat plan, you got to kind of look at the layout of the plan, where the bedding areas are going to be, or clearing food plots. If you're clearing food plots, you're taking anything of any value. And then you move into the bedding areas, you want to cut all that bigger timber anyway, so it leaves you the smaller stuff to work with to do the fine work. It also gives you some tops. You can move around, put them where you want them as far as deer travel, or visual barriers. And then in the areas where you don't necessarily want the deer, I'm doing more of a select cut in those areas, still cutting some of the trees, whether they're mature or they need to be cut. Maybe they're past maturity and they're going the other way, and dragging the tops right out of there so that you're not leaving anything for the deer. It's a undesirable area for the deer.
So what I'm getting out of this is, if you don't think about the harvesting element and you're just focusing on, I'm going to go in there and hinge cut a bunch of trees and I'm going to have bedding, and maybe you don't even have any value. So let's take that out of the equation. You walk into a job and you're like, all right, there's very few trees of significant value. We may want to regenerate a stand. We may want to do some variable thinning. You can start right on a habitat plan. But when it, and then also think kind of the timber management side of it, you know, doing maybe a TSI job or, a more in-depth cut to regenerate a stand because everything's ugly looking per se. But then when you get these properties that have timber value, you almost select that out first, but then you concentrate, you're almost saying, in the bedding areas and where those are located and what timber you need to remove from those specific areas. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. That's correct. Okay.
And I did miss one point. I mean, if you're in an area where, say there's a younger stand and there's not, maybe the trees are on the bottom end of maybe, you could cut them just reaching a marketable standpoint. Even at that point, I'm going through and doing some TSI. I'm just cutting down all the bad trees and leaving all the good ones just to get some texture in the ground, to eliminate the openness of the timber stand. So you're not necessarily cutting the big mature stuff. You're doing whatever's best for the woods, but also trying to get your deer habitat land done as well.
So in my plan specifically, and this is another strategy, is I'm employing specific cutting techniques in various areas around and within bedding areas. So the bedding area may have a certain strategy. It may have a volume. It may have a sunlight percentage. It may have some criteria. And those areas around that may have various other examples or other methodologies to cutting those areas. And this is in a woodlot area. And that all coincides with a movement, a plan, overarching transition strategy. There'll be transition zones, social zones. So there's a lot of intricacies that go into the plan that Josh has to consider when he's doing the layout. I will say that the correlation from the plan to the action is the one thing that a lot of people miss. And I've said this on the podcast multiple times. If you hire a consultant, let's just say you're hiring me, for example, and you have the ability to afford another day of work, or you're willing to have Josh come out and do the work, or whomever consultant you're hiring, to actually show you, and you can run with it, that's a great idea, because that gets the ball rolling. That's your community. You're building your community around your opportunity, and you're starting to understand how to attack particular problem and give yourselves kind of a solution and strategy to it. Because there's way more to this. There's intricacies to Josh, we build like requirements in an equation. We're going to cut these trees. This is why we're cutting this tree. This is that why that tree stays. I mean, there's real strategy that goes into every single tree that you're cutting in that environment. And I think it's a hard translation. And I've had opportunity to look at other consultants' maps and recognize that everyone's going to approach things slightly different. But there needs to be the implementation tied to that. And that's where a lot of people get lost. And I know you're seeing that in the field, right? They're having a hard time taking a map and starting to apply the techniques. Any thoughts on that topic?
It can be hard to take a map and put it on the ground. I mean, I know we've ran into a few situations where it looks great on the map and you get on the ground and you got to tweak things a little bit. It's not exactly where it's going to be on the map. Maybe you have to move a food plot or a bedding area. I think I've moved the food plot as much as 100 yards. Just because it didn't, I mean, looking at a soil map, the soil looked great, but you get in there and there's drainage off of a pond and it was too wet. It wouldn't have worked.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk logging roads. And I think that's probably a pretty critical strategy, something that should be built into a plan. Now, when I'm doing my design plans, I build in access roads. Which access roads are correlated with equipment, and that equipment could be logging equipment. So when you're thinking about your layout, you need to think about some specifics from a logging standpoint. Josh, when you're creating your logging roads on a property, what is your basic fundamental strategy for, just generally speaking, what technique do you, or what considerations do you have when you're creating a logging road?
For a logging road, I mean, it's you got to cut the trees down, you got to skid them out, and you got to get them to the landing. And every job, depending on how it lays out, whether it's sloped away from the landing, whether it's sloped towards the landing, or maybe it's dead flat, I mean, you have to approach it all differently. Say the hillside sloped towards the landing. So you have to, if it's fairly steep, you have to have one main road going up the hill, and you have to have side cuts going across to get all the timber. And on one like that, you have to start close to the landing. You have to start on the bottom. That way, as you fell trees, they're all falling downhill, and you just work your way up the hill.
Now, in some of those instances, you're worried about grade, right, the related slope. Maybe as towards the bottom, it may be a little bit wetter potentially, you know, so you're thinking about those things when you're starting to make your decisions. But I would say generally the path of least resistance tends to be the most normalized or used strategy when it comes to logging roads. Would that be generally true?
Yeah, that's a good theory. Okay. I mean, a lot of times I find myself having to go the opposite direction that I need to end up. Just to path the least resistance. I mean, that makes the most sense. Sometimes you got to go the long way around is the best way around.
The other piece of this is when you're doing the layout, and this is like my thought process, is you've got your logging trails that get you to areas you need to be to take out the timber. And if you can correlate those specific trails as maintenance or work trails, they compound on their purpose. And I think that's really important when you're starting to think about your layout. Then there's another piece of it. You know, do those trails allow you to get to areas where you can do the work that you need to do? But maybe those trails lead to food plots, or maybe those trails lead to hunting access areas. So you typically start with your logging trails. And then what you may need to do as a result of those potentially is you may need to block some of those particular trails, because Deer like easy paths. They like to go down a road that's open, maybe not too open, but open enough, and they don't have debris in their face. They can see. So sometimes you have to cut off those logging roads, put fencing up. And I know you've had to do this many times, Josh. You go in an area and you're cutting a logging road, you have to block it off. Any thoughts on that?
The easiest way I've found is put a top there. I mean, after when I'm done cleaning up all the logging roads, when I'm done getting all the timber out, getting all the roads cleaned up, I'll just put a tree top there wherever it needs to be. Sometimes they're scattered. And that correlates with the habitat plan as far as the deer travel.
Yeah, and I think, you know, part of that is some of those trails that we like to create deer trails by hand. And we like to have those trails be a little bit more, we'll say smaller in size. You know, ideally you can run a two-track size ATV, UTV down those particular trails. That's kind of the size I'm going for. Where these access trails or maintenance trails, they're at least 10 feet wide, normally speaking. They're at least 10 feet wide, if not 12 feet. And that would be like minimum for some of the equipment that we're talking about. What do you think about that?
Well said.
Okay, good. All right, so at least we think the same. And then the last piece of it is thinking about access trails associated with hunting locations. So picking the tree location out in accordance with the plan, knowing that, like, Josh, don't cut these four trees. Like, we'll mark them off because they're potential stand sites. And typically in stand locations, you want at least 2, 3, 4 available trees to hang a tree stand in to provide cover, or you're creating cover. And those things are important in the layout. So you have those pre-marked, and then you're creating access to those areas, and you're either using, and we talked about access in another podcast. If you have not listened to that, that's a pretty good podcast with me and Shippy. Go listen to that podcast. Thinking about, you know, how the deer will or will not travel down those access trails, and then how they will or will not travel on the maintenance trails, or, you know, the other trails that we talked about earlier, the logging road specifically. So it's starting to think how to block these things out. Any thoughts on any of that, Josh?
No, I mean, just your access points. You gotta try to access where the deer are not traveling, if you can.
Yeah. So it's almost like this healthy medium of you're bringing the deer to you, or bringing them to an area that you can hunt them in, but you're not bringing them close enough where you're going to intercept them, you know, or they're going to cut your track or cut your trail. I mean, that's pretty much the general goal of the design layout. And it really is that simple. I mean, I don't think of it as any more complicated. Now, there's other things that play in that equation of how's the ground slope, where your thermals are going to go, right? How wind travels through areas that are cut. I mean, there's more that goes into that equation. But generally speaking, we just don't want to intercept them or get them so close that we're going to create, you know, a negative reaction from the deer. That's pretty much the general goal.
Yep.
All right, moving right along. What do you want to talk about? Anything that's on your mind?
We've covered a lot of it.
We did. I got one more thing. So you go in and you run a dozer, a skidder, right? We talked about the Feller Buncher earlier. A lot of times when you're going to those areas, you create a lot of ground disturbance. And we talked about trying to minimize compaction. And the benefit of creating ground disturbance is you kind of remove leaf litter. The mineral soil mixes up. The smaller seed can germinate that's resident or in the future that drops. And likely because of the equipment being in those areas, we'll call that scarification or scraping the ground. Those are opportunities for plants to generate. And as a result of that, we have food for deer. And it seems really basic, but it's really critical to the overall equation. Now, Josh, when you cut an area, you know, your equipment's, you're very tactful on how you get into an area and, you know, you got to be efficient. But have you seen in a lot of those areas, quick regeneration? And have you seen in some of the areas where you've had equipment, you know, where you have scarified the ground or scraped the ground up, you see plants starting to develop in those areas, maybe either at a faster rate or plants that normally wouldn't generate would generate. Have you seen that?
I have.
All right. which I think
I had to think for a minute because I typically don't go back to my jobs, you know, a year or two later, usually a long time after that.
I know a couple strategies here. First off, burning areas. In some states you can and cannot burn. Some areas I've seen guys going with backpack blowers. Be smart when you do that. Moving the leaf litter. I've seen people throw out seed for turkeys. I've seen animals like turkeys clear off ground, right? They're looking for bugs. They're bugging. So, you know, there's natural ways to create the same type of environment. But the only way those plants will grow is with sunlight. So you need to create that environment for them. So removing the overstory is critical to that equation. So I would suggest people think about the volume of sunlight once they cut an area and what will happen as a result of that. Pretty basic, but pretty important. All right, let me talk about a problem. Damage. I hear this a lot. Damaging trees coming out of the woodlots. How do you approach that? What are some strategies you'd recommend?
That's a loaded question. As a logger, it's almost impossible to cut a whole woodlot and not have some sort of residual damage. So, I mean, for me, how I approach it is you want your trees at least at a 45 degree angle to your skid roads, where you're getting them from. I cut with a cable skidder, so I don't have to back right up to the trees. I got 100 foot of cable. So like on a hillside per se, I'll drop whatever 2, 3, 4 trees and get them. You want them at least at a 45 where you're pulling them up to. And once you get them to the machine, as you're skidding out, until you get on your main skid road, you want to do as little turning as possible, and you want to keep the trees as low as possible. And that helps with the scarring. But, you know, every time you pull a tree up, you risk damaging a tree, and sometimes you got to pull ahead, back up. You know, you might have to rehook a choker. And there can be a lot of work that goes into not leaving a lot of residual damage. And your main skid roads is where you see most of it. If you have I know on your piece there's a pretty good switchback coming up out of the bottom, and it's inevitable on something like that. And you just try to keep your hips low to the ground. That helps swing the trees around, and you still scar the tree up, but it's something like that. It's inevitable. It's going to happen.
Now, Josh, are you more worried about the residual stand, the trees that remain, and maybe in some cases you'll take some of the trees along the trail as a result of that? Might that be the case?
Yeah, if it's something where I'm working with a landowner on a percentage, if it's something that has been damaged pretty severely, then I'll cut it, and the landowner can get the money out of the tree, you know. And sometimes you're fighting gravity all the time. You only have so much control over a tree. I mean, I've broke tops off of, you know, a nice 15 inch maple that I was trying to save, and just, you know, gravity took over, tree spun off the stump, whatever it might be. And at that point, I'll take that tree at that point so that the landowner can get the money and out of that tree, because it'll just end up dying.
Yeah. Now, and maybe I missed this in the conversation. So if you're pulling trees out and you're worried about potential damage as it relates to the bark that's on the trees that you're already taking, are you that concerned about that? I'm thinking about uneven ground with a lot of rocks. You know, does that degrade the log at the landing site after you bring it down there? And does that hurt your potential money opportunity?
It can. It's more... It's a time thing. I mean, if you take the bark off, say a really nice hard maple, you know, you scuff the bark off, you know, 12, 16 inches off the ground, it's not going to kill that tree. If that tree is getting cut in the next 20 years, you might lose a little bit on the bottom, but above that, there's no damage.
All right. So there's kind of a balancing act that you play when you're doing your logging and thinking about your trails and getting trees out And then obviously you go back in and clean up the logging roads. When is most appropriate for that? Because I know that doesn't always happen immediately after you finish a logging job. And obviously if you have some time because your contracts allow that. Typically, what's your strategy around that?
Just the weather. I mean, that's part of why I like 2-year contracts. I tell any guy I cut in the wintertime, I'll be back in the spring or summer whenever it dries up. You know, sometimes around here, that might not be till June or July. And it's just all, you can't clean it up if it's wet. It just, you're fighting mud. So I'll wait till it dries out, and then you can do a nice job on the cleanup.
Yeah, so I would say for anybody who's drafting a contract, that's, you know, that's spelled right out that, you know, that you're overseeing, or, I mean, maybe there's a forester overseeing, or, you know, you're working with your logger directly to make sure that the cleanup is at the appropriate time, and they come back to do that. That's part of the contract. You could have withhold. You could have some dollars held back to ensure that that job gets done. You could put a value associated with that, you know, a couple thousand, you know, whatever the specifics may be that you're able to hold in your purse temporarily until, you know, that work is performed. Just a thought process there that you might want to go through in your contract. All right. I think I'm out of ideas right now, so I'm going to lean on you. Anything else you want to talk about on this podcast? I mean, we've covered more than I've listened to a lot of podcasts, and I think we've covered more in these two podcasts on our specific business and how we operate and strategy than I think I've ever heard on any other habitat hunting podcast, at least at this point. I mean, there's way more specifics that I haven't explained, or I think we could talk for days about this stuff. Is there anything that you feel is critical?
I'm trying to think if we missed anything. The only thing I can think of is there is a couple different scales that guys buy on. And right here where we're at, it's pretty much all Doyle. There is there's one company I can think of, well, two companies I can think of that run on a Scribner scale. In my opinion, that's probably a little bit closer to the actual board footage in the tree on the smaller stuff. And as it gets bigger, it's not much of a difference. It's about the same as the Doyle. And that is one thing to consider when you're selling wood. If you're working with a logger and he's talking about pricing, the Scribner would be, the Scribner is typically a lower dollar per thousand than the Doyle. And that's just due to board footage. They're going to have more board footage on Scribner than they will on Doyle. So the price per thousand will be a little bit less. And there is the international scale, but that's just softwood. I don't really see that very often.
When we have like, I guess, softwoods or low grade timber in our areas, how are those typically sold? By the ton?
Yes, by the ton. Okay. The low grade, you know, your firewood and scrag is typically, I shouldn't say typically, but can be sold on the ton by weight.
Now, I feel like in the Midwest, they sell it in cords, but I could be wrong. I forget what the scale or how they use that.
I've heard that, and I don't know exactly how that works.
Not our area that we work in, but I think that is the case. Well, who knows? You know, maybe we'll be out west cutting jobs or overseeing jobs at some point. Not sure about that, but likely on the horizon, more than likely for us. All right. I think that's good. I'm not sure I have much to add. I think this is, like I said earlier, this pretty well-rounded podcast. I feel like we've hit a lot of key points. Anything you want to say to anybody out there listening? How do they get a hold of you, Josh? Because we didn't say that last time. They obviously can get a hold of me to get a hold of you. You work obviously directly with my clients, and you know, normally we have a property management plan before you get involved with my clients. But you know, you are available to cut timber locally. If there is a deer management piece of it, we typically work that out into the equation. But how do they get a hold of you?
You could email me at jslogging2330@gmail.com.
Awesome. And if anybody needs that information, I'll have it in the notes, and you can obviously get a hold of me and I'll put you in touch with Josh. Josh and I work together on jobs, so I appreciate, you know, his expertise, and I'm happy that we had this talk about today, buddy.
You know, I don't know why you got to pick on me like that. I was having a moment.
You were. And he's like, hey, I want to do the next podcast. And, or you said talk about, I want to do the next talk about, and, I'm not really sure what we should get into. And I was just laughing because, you know, this is the next age. You know, I also will say, I'm thinking, and I haven't confirmed this, but I'll bring this up if people have interest in this. I was contacted a week ago, and there's a speaking engagement in September. There's quite a few people going to it. They asked me to be a keynote there. I haven't done a lot of speaking engagements, and I think I'm going to go. I think, Josh, you might go as well. We're going to bring maybe some of our mounts, and I think I'll tell a few sob stories, you know, get people crying for me because I'm just this wizard up there of conversation. But, you know, I think that I'm going to do, and I'll introduce it probably in the next podcast if I for sure I'm going to do that speaking engagement or not. But I think you might attend that with me as well. So you can meet both of us. I may invite maybe Tim Russell. He's a local guy. He's been on this podcast to kind of come and attend. So I think that's in the Canandaigua area, Canandaigua, New York. If you are interested in speaking engagements and telling stories and those things and real strategy, you know, reach out to me. I'm considering doing more of that because there has been interest in this area. And I think it's a good opportunity for people to learn, you know, learn from my mistakes or learn from my wins. And I'm happy to share all that type of stuff. So, you know, more to come on that. And hopefully Josh will be there if he can find the time because he likes to go on vacation a lot. All right, buddy, we're at the end of our rope here. I think you're good. I'm good. Thank you for being a part of this thing. And I think you're good at the talk about, so we'll have you on again.
Thanks. I appreciate that. That was a good talk about.
Sounds good. Talk to you soon. See ya.
Bye.
Maximize Your Hunt is a production of Whitetail Landscapes. For more information on how John Teeter and his team of experts can help you maximize your hunt, check out whitetaillandscapes.com.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.